Wish I was a mole in the ground. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement. The Old Mole is a radio zine that comes at you every Monday morning, 9 to 10 a.m., with an hour of interviews, reviews, commentary, music, and perspective on how we can build a more democratic world.
Tear those mountains down.
Abortion rights in the 20th century was most severe following World War II, and I think is part of the dynamic of the repression of reproductive rights is the desire to control what is considered as the destabilizing effect of rampant female sexuality, if you want to put it that way.
Well, you could. Yeah. The idea of women being not only overtly sexual, but not simply as targets of interest from male people, but of their own selves, that was definitely not appreciated.
Tear those mountains down.
Where were you on this day, November 29th, 22 years ago? How about 5 years ago? For some of our listeners, for some of the old moles, at this hour, on this day, in 1999, we were gathering by buses on the way to Seattle to shut down the World Trade Organization, that effort to impose a corporation-dominated board over and beyond any national governmental institutions. That action, it's important to remember, was part of a democratic movement building worldwide.
Tear those mountains down.
The Civil War had been raging for more than a year, and Black abolitionists, who had been increasingly pressuring Lincoln to end slavery, must have felt a sense of great anticipation and pride. The war was not going well for Lincoln. Britain was contemplating whether to intervene on the Confederacy's behalf, and Lincoln, unable to draw enough new white volunteers for the war, was forced to reconsider his opposition to allowing Black Americans to fight for their own liberation.
Tear those mountains down.
Policing has to change. Alex Vitale, it's really a wonderful book. But first, what's wrong with modern policing?
Well, I think we have a pretty good sense of what the major problems are. Over the last 5 years with the rise of Black Lives Matter, we have a very good understanding about the excesses of police violence and the lack of accountability. I think what needs more attention is the broader problem of over-policing.
Tear those mountains down.
The monster who came up the river. This huge monster came up from the ocean. He would open his huge mouth and inhale anything that was in his path.
We've been recognizing this story by Esther Motanik, but as you say, there are many stories to tell, and they play in all cultures a vital role and have an important place and in inspiring people during a time that can seem bleak and hopeless, but also as we try to find a way forward through this climate catastrophe we're in.
Yep, we have to be coyote. We have to be creative. We have to think right.
Tear those mountains down.
The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Tune in for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kullberg, and I will be your host this morning for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The clip you just heard is a taste of what the moles have been up to this past year. I wanted to play this short piece for you that we produce for World Radio Day because KBOO has just kicked off its winter drive. If you would like to support the moles and the work we do, the best way is to support KBOO, your volunteer-powered, non-commercial radio station. KBOO makes possible shows like ours, which bring you the kinds of stories that you won't usually hear on corporate radio. To keep us going, we depend on you, our listeners. If you can, please make a contribution today in support of community radio. You can go to kboo.fm/give. You can click on the donate button in your mobile app. You can text KBOO to 44321, or you can give by snail mail and send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. On this day, February 21st, in 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated. Like Martin Luther King Jr., who would be murdered a scant 3 years later, Malcolm X was a restless and careful thinker who continued to learn from his life experiences and rethink his ideas. They were both men of conscience. Both grappled for a deeper systemic understanding of racism and actively worked for a radical transformation of U.S. society. Like King, Malcolm X paid the price for his willingness to embrace radical ideas. Mainstream historians often seek to neutralize persons whose ideas run counter to the status quo of racial capitalism. Control over historical narratives is a tool being used today, as it has been in the past, to keep certain ideas out of the public consciousness. For Malcolm X, this has meant being vilified and dismissed as a radical and racist demagogue. MLK is too large a figure to sideline in this dishonest way. Instead, his legacy has been sanitized, cleansed of his evolving anti-capitalist analysis and growing belief that the problem of racism could not be understood apart from the economic system from which it arises and in which it is embedded. For Paul Robeson, another towering Black artist and activist who had well-known communist sympathies, the solution for those who rewrite history has been simply to erase him. Later on in our show, we're going to look at a recent effort to resurrect the legacy of Paul Robeson in an interview by Luisa Martinez with Sharon Rudall, who published a graphic biography of Robeson in 2019. Following that conversation, Sharon Grant, our well-read Red, will be reading from two articles that examine the long and fruitful collaboration between radical leftists and Black cultural workers like Robeson, Lorraine Hansberry, Alice Childress, and Bea Richards. Before our dive into Black radical history, Bill Resnick will take a look at another struggle to wrest the future away from capitalist interests. He'll be talking with physicist and activist M.V. Ramana about the struggle between corporate elites and left activists over the control of our energy future. Will it be for profit or for the benefit of everyone? Which approach can actually save our planet from climate disaster? This is the first of a two-part interview.
Ramana, welcome to KABU again.
Thank you, Bill.
Ramana started as a physicist who came to be alarmed by the spread of nuclear weapons. He's taught, researched, written, and agitated at the Nuclear Futures Laboratory and the Program on Science and Global Security, both at Princeton University. He's now at the University of British Columbia School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. Ramana is a member of the International Nuclear Risk Assessment Group and the team that produces the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report, which unfortunately gets longer and more alarming every year. Over the years, Ramana has come to recognize that climate change joins nuclear weapons and nuclear accidents as imminent looming threats to human life. And he began studying energy, particularly how to replace both nuclear and fossil fuel energy, and in the process, restore planetary ecosystems. He and several colleagues recently wrote the article, How Electric Utilities Thwart Climate Action, Politics, and Power. That's in this month's edition of the journal Against the Current. The article discusses one of the several ways that investor-owned utilities and their financiers and investors try to remain in control and make their huge profits. How do they do that? By stretching out the time of getting to net zero and then slowly substituting big natural gas plants for the big coal-burning plants and later replacing gas with huge remote sun and wind farms. This, of course, ignores the science that calls for substantial reduction of gas concentrations in the near future. So, Ramana, tell us about that part of the investor-owned utility and financier and investor strategy.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is very important, and I'm thankful to you, Bill, for highlighting this in your program. Though there is now much greater recognition of the crisis that climate change poses and the necessity to reduce emissions quickly, these large electric utilities, and electricity contributes a fairly substantial fraction of emissions in every country, the production of electricity, the utilities that own these large power plants have all tried to maintain their profitability and their revenue streams by talking about climate change, but trying to avoid changing their investment portfolios in any major way. As you mentioned, the one source of power they have moved away from to some extent is coal. Coal has used to be a very central element in the generation portfolios for most of these electric utility companies. But over the years, it has just received too much negative press. There are protesters on the street, and I think they've decided, and maybe some of them have been genuinely convinced by the science of climate change, to think that they should move away from coal. But the same science would also tell them that they should not be investing in natural gas plants. And this is for two reasons. The first is that natural gas plants also involve the burning of fossil fuels, and therefore when the natural gas is burnt at the plant, it will be emitting carbon dioxide. The amount of emissions of carbon dioxide per unit of electricity produced in a natural gas plant is about half of that of a coal plant. And so it's somewhat better than coal in one sense. But the natural gas plants, as their name suggests, require the use of natural gas. And the natural gas has to be produced somewhere. In the United States, this is being fueled by the boom in what is called fracking, or hydraulic fracturing is the more technically accurate name. And we know from a number of studies that the places where the natural gas is extracted and how it is being transported to the different places where the natural gas is used, there are leaks all across the fuel chain. And when methane leaks, that is also a greenhouse gas. And in fact, in the short term, methane is much more powerful in terms of holding on to the radiation that is incoming from the sun and increasing the temperature than carbon dioxide. And therefore, when utility companies invest in natural gas plants, they are contributing to climate change. They will be continuing to contribute to climate change. But also, if you think about the way that the industry tries to sell that, is to say natural gas is going to be a bridge fuel. Eventually, we will move to a much more renewable energy power future, but we are not there yet. And so right now, we need natural gas as a stepping stone. The problem there is that any of these power plants is a massive investment, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And when companies do those kinds of investments, they have to recoup those costs over an extended period of time. A typical lifetime, operating lifetime for any of these plants is about 40 years. So if a company is investing in a natural gas plant today, it is doing so under the expectation that this plant is going to be operating for the next 30, 40 years at least. Otherwise, it's going to be losing out money on that in that process. And so the switch to natural gas is not really going to help us with mitigating climate change as the time for much more rapid emissions approaches.
But they have another story, it seems to me, reading the corporate literature. Yes, we'll be producing and emitting natural gas. the natural gas wells. There are thousands and thousands in the United States. All of them leak. One has no idea of how much methane is in the atmosphere, although some studies apparently have been done in local areas, and it's more than anybody wants to admit. But they have another story, which is we are the leader in technology in the world. We've revolutionized production and communications in the United States in just a few years. Our engineers are top flight, and we're going to develop new technologies. They're on the drawing board, and some of them are even being tested, they say, that one way or another, some of them will absorb carbon dioxide. Some of them allegedly will change carbon dioxide into usable products, and they can capture it. And a lot of it could be sequestered. Carbon sequestering is one way, some kind of dream of reforestation. They're cutting down the forest, but they seem to think that they can grow enough forest to do all of the work. Most of it is just pie in the sky. It's talk, but they are getting away with it. And the small nukes is the worst of their new technologies. But these nukes, Ramana, they'll be safe. We reassure you. You can be sure, and there's no problem in where to put all that waste. It's piling up now.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, well, you put your finger on the thing. So they have another discursive strategy, if you like, you know, how they dress up what they are doing. And the term that has become very popular now is net zero. Rather than zero emissions, now they all aim to achieve what they call net zero emissions. And what does that mean? It's exactly what you said, that, you know, somehow you would assume that there would be a way to absorb carbon dioxide in somewhere else in the world that would compensate for the carbon dioxide that they are releasing. And how this is going to happen is through envisioned to be through a mixture of familiar ways of absorbing carbon dioxide, like growing forests, and revolutionary new technologies that would absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and convert it into some solid product, either usable or something that can be kept underneath the ground somehow. Now, the problem with that is if you're thinking about carbon dioxide, absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, plants and trees do it, and they do it as part of their natural growth. But the problem there is, of course, that we are cutting down forests because of various requirements for land, and there is only a finite amount of land. And if you're going to be growing forests in places where people are growing food, for example, and typically these things happen in the developing world where, you know, there is acute conflicts over land as it is. But the more pie-in-the-sky strategy are these technologies that are supposed to be absorbing carbon dioxide using artificial means and putting it underground in some fashion or converting into usable products. The challenge there is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has a very low concentration. You know, we know that it's 400 parts per million or 500 parts per million. This is the numbers that we hear about as the emissions are increasing. So you're trying to capture 400 to 500 molecules out of every million molecules that are there in the atmosphere. And as you can imagine, that kind of a process will require a very large amount of air to be sent through some surface, which will capture that carbon dioxide. And that's a very energy-intensive process. So what we are trying to talk about is that the greenhouse gas problem is fundamentally because of the ways we produce energy. And now we are going to try to use more energy to try and capture the carbon dioxide that has been put in there. Okay. The second issue with carbon capture is, again, the old problem of how to make it profitable. Now, because this is a hugely energy-intensive process and because it requires a lot of equipment, it is an expensive process. And the question is, who is going to pay for that and how is it going to be paid for? So the way that these technologies have been developed is to use it for something called enhanced oil recovery, which is that if you have an oil field where oil is being pumped out, the idea is that these carbon capture plants would try to capture carbon dioxide and pump it down into those old oil wells. And when this new carbon dioxide goes into the old oil well, it will push out some of the oil that's still stuck there, right? And so these fossil fuel companies have been trying to use carbon capture to increase their oil production, which if it sounds kind of contradictory, then it is contradictory.
It's absurd, because then they burn the oil.
Exactly.
They tell that to politicians. They have scientists who work on it. If you go, I think of this, to the Aramco, the Saudi Arabian oil company, on the first page in Aramco, they talk about their carbon capture technology and then proudly point out that it's being used to enhance their oil production. It's so absurd, but they have men and women in white, and women too, incidentally, in white lab coats doing all of these things. And it looks very high tech, of course. And the plants that they have, the plumbing is just, you know, very impressive. All of the pipes and tubes and everything, and the people, everything is nice and clean. It's just absurd, but they have the power to sell that stuff. They're sort of promoting themselves as recognizing the threat of climate change, and we're doing our part in dealing with it. That's what they're telling people. And
yeah, this points to two contradictions we have. One is, you know, in our capitalist system, as you know, Bill, everything has to be looked at through the lens of profitability, right? And so the only way these companies like Aramco and so on can increase their profits or keep their profits up is by continuing to produce fossil fuels right now, right? So that is one motivation that keeps them going. But there's a second and more underlying larger motivation that's not just the fossil fuel companies, but the many other entities in the corporate world and in the political world that support these, which is the idea that somehow the system is good as it is, it's fine, and we need to maintain the current social, political, and economic system to the extent possible while, quote-unquote, mitigating climate change. Okay, and people have to be convinced that those who are in power know the answers to how to solve climate change. And that's why there's this great pretense about how new technology, revolutionary technology, is going to come in and solve all the problems. You mentioned small modular nuclear reactors. That's one of the suite of these technologies that are supposed to come in and save the world. There are all of the technologies that we talked about in carbon capture and storage are like that. And even to some extent, some of the things that could be associated with renewable energy, like hydrogen. And there's a lot of hype about it because the ruling class requires us to have narratives that show them saving the world, even though it's apparent to everybody that we are going to hell in a handbasket.
Yes, their hypocrisy is boundless, for they argue we must preserve the current system because we're on the road to wiping out poverty and disease. In fact, they are perfectly happy with mass poverty, disease, precariousness. The UN estimates to end extreme poverty that the total cost per year would be $175 billion, less than 1% of combined income of the richest countries in the world. The richest men and countries make much more money mining the richest of the resources of the poor countries, but there is no move to take part of it to end the suffering of extreme hunger. Nor, of course, are they willing to interrupt their accumulation of monies to deal with the grave threat of climate change. On that sorry note, we must end this part one of my two-part interview with Romana. As Romana has explained in this first part, their plans are completely self-serving, and much of their previous research has gone nowhere. Government-funded research has gone nowhere. That their current efforts in geoengineering create great dangers, as do their plans for great numbers of new allegedly small nuclear plants spread across rural areas. In the second half of this interview, Ramon and I will discuss how the struggle between the corporate plan and the environmental and left plan is growing furious, and how the corporate center are using their political and economic power to stifle the on-the-ground actual development. It's really happening now of that climate action and environmental program. So, Ramana, talk to you soon. Thanks a lot.
You just heard an interview by Bill Resnick with M.V. Ramana about the struggle for control over our energy future. The music was from Babe's Blues by Randy Weston, the great jazz artist who passed in 2018. Weston was known for his emphasis on African rhythms. He once said of his music, "In Africa, I discovered what the true purpose of a musician is. We are historians, and it is our purpose to tell the people the true story of our past and to extend a better vision of the future." You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and we are now in our All Thrills, No Frills Winter Drive. As part of the drive, KBOO is bringing you a month of special musical and public affairs programming, including a dance party marathon, a series on Black history, and a special on International Women's Day. To see what's on the schedule, go to kboo.fm. It's all right there on our homepage. And while you're there, you can click on the big donate button and become a part of the KBOO community. You can also text KBOO to 44321, or send a check by snail mail to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. We need your support to stay on the air, and a big thanks to all of you who have given so generously in the past. Now I'd like to turn to Luisa Martinez and her interview with Sharon Rudall, artist and writer of a graphic biography of Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American. Rudall was commissioned by Rutgers University Press to create the novel both as a way to honor Robeson, a Rutgers alum, and to create a biography of him accessible to people of all ages. Robeson was a world-renowned African-American athlete, singer, actor, scholar, and activist who fought for anti-colonialism, civil rights, and international peace. The book was published in 2019 on the centenary of his graduation from Rutgers. This interview originally aired on April 26, 2021. The segment begins with Robeson singing Joe Hill.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man.
says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they forgot to kill went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Hey there. This is Luisa Martinez, and I will be interviewing artist Sharon Rudall. Sharon provided the artwork and text for the book, Graphic Biography of Paul Robeson, Ballad of an American. It's edited by Paul Buell and Lawrence Ware. Sharon marched with Martin Luther King as a teenager and began her career as a cartoonist with anti-Vietnam War underground newspapers. She was one of the founders of the 1970s-era feminist women's comics, spelled W-I-M-M-E-N-C-O-M-I-X. She is best known for her graphic biography, Emma Goldman, A Dangerous Woman. So good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, Luisa.
Thanks for joining us. And let me ask, can you first tell us a little bit about Robeson's extraordinary life and career?
Well, Paul Robeson is probably the most famous African-American in American modern history that's been forgotten. I was surprised after I did this that he's still been so much forgotten. He was disappeared during the McCarthy era, and he's never entirely been brought back. He was a great athlete. He was a great opera singer and concert singer. He was a very popular actor in theater and in movies, and he was a great activist. He spoke with First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt to support the American war effort in World War II and appeared on her radio show. He was a really important representative of the Black community, and he was embraced by people all over the world as an agent of activism and change. But during the McCarthy era, he was attacked as a communist and completely disappeared from records of his athletic achievements. His movies were discontinued. He wasn't given any venues to perform, and he's still inadequately remembered.
So let me ask, why a graphic biography of Robeson? What can a graphic novel tell us or convey to us about his life where text maybe falls short?
Well, from my point of view, because that's what I do, is tell stories with pictures, Rutgers University, where Paul Robeson was an alumni, and he was Phi Beta Kappa and won 14 awards in athletics. And he was a big star of Rutgers. In spite of having a great difficulty getting in, he won by competitive exam that he was actually a racist teacher, actually kept him from knowing about the exam that would have given him free tuition, but he got in. So now Rutgers is proud of him, and it's just about the 100th anniversary of his graduation in 1919. And they decided, the people at Rutgers, that they wanted a graphic biography, and they contacted my longtime collaborator, Paul Buell. And Paul Buell contacted me, he said, because I was the only popular front artist he knew. I didn't know what that meant at the time, but apparently it means that, you know, I'll go out and work for any cause. It sounds good to me. Which put me on the same page with Paul Robeson, and I draw pretty good. So that's how I got this job. Why is it good to present it as a graphic story? I think people absorb graphic stories in a way, in a different way than they absorb print. And not to say one is better than the other, but I think there are people that can be reached by words and pictures that might not be reached by just one or the other. When I wrote this, the script, I tried to keep it so that if I was explaining something to my sons when they were, you know, 12 or 14, rather than little children or adults, but to make understandable what was important and complicated, but nonetheless, what needed to be understandable at their level, and backing it up with pictures. I think it opens it up to more people than having it just be one or the other.
So you've committed yourself to social justice. You had Paul describe you as a Popular Front artist. How do you think that differentiates your art and the lens through which you express yourself versus other artists?
Well, in working on the poems and book, as with any other work where it's based on an actual person, it's something like being an actor doing a biography, in that you try to find places where what you are inside matches the person who you're trying to present. And one of the things Paul said that I really felt close to is he said, in a socialist country, I work for free. In a capitalist country, I work for as much as I can get. So in my career, there is definitely work I won't do, but there's work that's sort of morally neutral that I'll do for a good pay. And then there's work that's so important to me that I'll do whatever I have to do to stay alive to do it, even if there's no money coming in. I have to say that activist art saved me rather than the other way around. I went to an all-scholarship art school in New York at the height of the op art and canvases being either all black or all white and sculpture being metal cubes. And it was terribly frustrating. It was nothing that I had hoped for in becoming an artist. And I graduated and there was nothing I felt I could do. And I was actually approached by people who needed a poster for bail money to get someone out of jail who had been involved in anti-Vietnam War activism. And that really saved my life artistically. So, you know, it's just like people who say, I rescued this animal, but this animal rescued me. Well, activist art really gave me what I'd always been looking for in art, which was a purpose. I mean, if I had been a medieval monk, I would have done the lives of saints. As a 21st century artist, I do the life of Paul Robeson. And I find that something meaningful enough that I can put myself into it completely, which I couldn't do today. With, to me, gallery art is, it's like Bitcoin or something. I mean, don't get me started.
Well, you know, back to Robeson, there were so few opportunities for Black artists, and what was available would be universally dismissed as racist and sexist by modern standards. So, for instance, as portrayed in the book, one of his most successful plays early on in his career, The Emperor Jones, is about a railroad porter who moves to the West Indies and declares himself king and brutalizes natives. There are countless depictions of Robeson as a continental African in a really unflattering way in plays such as The Sanders of the River. And so how do you reconcile this unfortunate position that he was put in with your obligation to portray some of the humanizing aspects of his life? So when he had to play these roles that really just perpetuated racist stereotypes, how do you do it with sympathy?
Okay, so this was one of the things that I did think through. Normally when I get a job, I just kind of lunge in ahead and then, you know, try to put it into some sort of form. But I felt like I did need to deal with those roles. And what I decided to do, I don't know if you're familiar with either the movie or the play Kiss of the Spider Woman. It's a political activist and a gay man are in prison together, and they tell stories about movies with this Spider Woman character, that the movies come to life and become the tissue that holds the story of their actual lives together. I decided to actually tell the stories in at least little snippets from them in ways that I could make them fun and not make them offensive. There's the things that you lump together are actually important to keep apart. The Emperor Jones was by someone who's supposed to be, I'm looking for this here, but he was one of the most acclaimed modern playwrights that was supposed to really understand the Black experiences and stuff. And of course, it was complete garbage and other words that I would use if we weren't on air. And most of the others you mentioned really were just popular low-level entertainments. I'd like to bring up just recently for Black History Month, they showed a documentary on Sidney Poitier on my public television station. And they were throwing the same sort of opprobrium at him, that he always portrayed a Black that was easy for whites to take. And then at the end it said, yes, but that opened the door that otherwise wouldn't have been opened for other Black performers. Well, that actually made me really mad. Sidney Poitier was a tremendous Paul Robeson supporter. And Paul Robeson's the one that opened that door. He opened it for Sidney Poitier and opened it for everybody else. Samuel L. Johnson and, you know, whatever, any Black artist, theatrical or movie artist you want to name, that door was opened a generation or two ago by Paul Robeson, by his tremendous success. You know, and it's also true. I mean, if you have any friends that are performers, getting any kind of a job is so hard. And then supporting a family and supporting your various hangers-on, people cannot afford to be that picky who are in the performing arts. But I also think Paul Robeson was just a very open-hearted, jolly, he loved to dance, he loved to sing, he loved to make music. You know, he was happy to perform. I don't think he looked at it through that lens until quite late in life, and late in his career, active career life, when he did start turning down roles if he didn't think they expressed his political views, and being a lot more forceful about choosing roles that he could embody. And I also think he got tricked a lot. Sanders of the River, I know they told him it would be actually filmed in Africa with actual footage of tribes. And I don't think he had any idea until he saw the final cut just how disparaging it was.
Okay. Well, lastly, any quick kind of words of advice for aspiring artists who do take a social justice to their artwork?
Well, following on my comments about how hard it is to get work as a performer, it's pretty hard to get work as an artist. I'd say the first thing to do is just take any opportunity you have. For me, it was doing flyers for demonstrations and posters to get people out of jail. And that's how I honed my craft. And then later working on underground newspapers, you know, for less than no pay, we had to come up with the money to print our papers. Take any opportunity you have to hone your craft, carry a sketch pad. There are new opportunities online that didn't exist when I was getting started. I don't have the specific information because I don't even know how to turn the computer on, but I've been told there's sites where you can post your work and people can comment on it and you can find a way to make small amounts of money on it and kind of build on that. But the main thing is, if you really want to do it, just start doing it and keep doing it.
Thanks so much, Sharon, for joining us.
Thank you, Louisa, for giving me the opportunity.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this head below.
Oh, by and by.
I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, one of these mornings bright and fair,
I'm gonna lay down my heavy load.
My wings and cleave the air.
I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
Oh, by and by,
by and by, I'm gonna lay down this heavy load.
That was Louisa Martinez with Sharon Rudall on Rudall's graphic biography of Paul Robeson. The final song, entitled By and By, I'm Going to Lay Down This Heavy Load, was sung by Paul Robeson together with Lawrence Brown. KBOO's winter membership drive is now in progress. We're asking you, our loyal listeners, to support volunteer-powered, non-commercial radio in Portland. KBOO is your source for news and analysis that goes beyond what you hear on commercial radio, to get at the roots of what ails us, and also to highlight the work of activists, especially locally, to build a more just and equitable society. Shows like More Talk Radio, Locus Focus, Counterspin, Flashpoints, and the Old Mole Variety Hour keep you informed about the issues and happenings that matter most to you. Please help keep community radio alive in Portland by donating to KBOO today. You can go to kboo.fm/give to donate. You can also text KBOO to 44321 or send a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. And thanks to everyone who has supported KABU over the years. Black artists of music, song, theater, fiction, and poetry have a long association with radical left politics. During the 1940s and 50s, the socialist sympathies of Black artists like Paul Robeson, Lorraine Hansberry, Alice Childress, and Bea Richards turned them into targets of the FBI, leading to gross violations of their civil rights. Sharon Grant reads excerpts from an article by Mohammed El-Nayem entitled, "In the McCarthy Era, to be Black was to be Red." Sharon follows up with a reading from another article by Ashanta Jackson entitled, "The Poem That Inspired Radical Black Women to Organize." The poem was written by Black actor Bea Richards, and she first performed it at the 1950 American People's Peace Congress. Richards went on to become a co-founder of the civil rights organization Sojourners for Peace and Justice.
This is KABU.FM Portland. I'm Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's Black History Month, and I'll do something a little different to acknowledge it by reading excerpts from two articles printed in the J Store Daily Newsletter. The first is titled, "In the McCarthy Era, to be Black was to be Red," as communists, socialists, and radicals came to be called in the 50s. It was written by Mohammed El-Nayem, printed November 13, 2019. The second, also printed in the J Store Daily Newsletter, November 5, 2020, is by Shantae Jackson, titled, "The Poem That Inspired Radical Black Women to Organize." The Marxist sympathies of Black radical leaders like Paul Robeson, Alice Childress, and Lorraine Hansberry made them targets for the FBI. Society adored them, but the US government thought they were dangerous. Black radical leaders, Paul Robeson, Alice Childress, and Lorraine Hansberry, who transformed the cultural sphere in the United States and beyond. They were playwrights, singers, and performers, but they were also rabble-rousers, dissidents, and even enemies of the state. Paul Robeson was a giant, both in the struggle for civil rights, but more importantly, as an actor, playwright, and singer. He shared the World Peace Prize with Picasso and Pablo Neruda. He could count among his friends Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, and Nehru, the first prime minister of India. The famed anarchist Emma Goldman, no friend to statesmen, also considered him a dear friend. Alice Childress would become the first Black woman to professionally produce a play in the United States, and years later, the only African-American woman to have been a playwright for four decades. In the 1950s, the general public learned about these figures by flicking through art magazines and the New York Times, reading reviews about the groundbreaking advancements they made for the Black arts. From the perspective of the FBI, however, their names were known for another reason, an infamous watch list, which set its sights on perceived traitors to the nation. Because of their association with Black theater projects like the Committee for the Negro of the Arts, or for Robeson and Hansberry, because they were open about being Marxists, the US government led a concerted effort to banish them from the public eye. After House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, began targeting artists, Childress too appeared on the FBI's watch list for her activism and her open association with communists. HUAC investigated allegations of communist activity in the United States during the early years of the Cold War, though it existed from 1945 to 1991. When the names Robeson, Hansberry, and Childress appeared on the FBI list of suspected communists, they were accompanied by the name of Harry Belafonte, the man who would become one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s most trusted confidants. Because during the era of McCarthyism, to be Black was to be Red. Ashanta Jackson mentions in "The Poem That Inspired Radical Black Women to Organize," printed in the J Store Daily Newsletter, Bea Richards, an actor perhaps best known for her work in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, wrote, a Black woman speaks of white womanhood, of white supremacy, of peace in 1950, and first performed it at the American People's Peace Congress, a radical multiracial peace network that the US State Department denounced for allegedly following the Communist Party line, in quotes, in 1951. There's always a catalyst for any movement, and for the Sojourners of Truth and Justice, it started with a poem. Throughout this sweeping poem, Richards connected race, gender, and class for a crowd of 500 women at the Peace Congress. And the poem goes, "I speak not mockingly, but I fought for freedom. I am fighting now for our unity. We are women all, and what wrongs you murders me, and eventually marks your grave. So we share a mutual death at the hand of tyranny. I would that the poor among you could have seen through the scheme and joined hands with me. Then we, being the majority, could long ago have rescued our wasted lives," unquote. The reception was overwhelming, and the Women's Workshop helped to publish it as a pamphlet. This eventually brought Richards to another realm as a co-founder of the civil rights organization, Sojourners for Peace and Justice, which used A Black Woman Speaks as a framework for its efforts. The poem had been a spark for the founding of Sojourners for Truth and Justice. As historian Ashley D. Farmer writes, the organization, quote, "developed a communist, Black nationalist, and feminist agenda to end Black women's oppression." Several Sojourners, including Richards, were put under years-long government surveillance under suspicion of being communist. This is Sharon Grant for the OMO Variety Hour on In the McCarthy Era, To Be Black Was to Be Red.
Archie Shepp is another jazz musician whose musical career has been closely associated with the civil rights movement. His album, Fire Music, includes a spoken elegy to Malcolm X. What you just heard was a clip from his song, I Know About the Life. Before that, you heard a reading by Sharon Grant of two articles about the left and Black cultural workers in the early 20th century. A link to both articles can be found on the webpage for today's show at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. That does it for our show this morning. Thanks to Mole's Bill Resnick, Louisa Martinez, and Sharon Grant for their contributions, and to Denise Morris for her editing and production assistance, and, of course, to the hardworking staff at KBOO. A special thanks to our guests this morning, Sharon Rudall and M.V. Romana. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for today's show. Before we conclude this morning, I want to remind you that you are listening to volunteer-powered and listener-supported radio, and that we depend on listeners like you for ongoing support. Tune in to the special programs coming up as part of our All Thrills, No Frills campaign, including an International Women's Day special, an R&B hip-hop marathon, and a series on Black history and the future. The schedule of our special programming is available at kboo.fm. Our thanks to everyone who has donated to keep community radio alive in Portland. If you can, please become a member of the KBOO community. Send us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Click on our donate button on our homepage at kboo.fm or simply text KBOO to 44321. I'd like to leave you today with one last musical clip from jazz artist Charles Mingus called Fables of Faubus. Mingus wrote the song in protest against Arkansas Governor Orval Faubus, who called out the National Guard to prevent the admission of 9 black students to the all-white Little Rock Central High School in 1957. In its first recording, Columbia Records refused to include the lyrics to the song. The version you are about to hear, known as Original Fables of Faubus, was released on the label Candid in 1960. Thanks for listening, and catch us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. Stay safe and stay active.
Oh, Lord, don't let them shoot us. Oh, Lord, don't let them stab us. Oh, Lord, don't let them confeder us. Oh, Lord, no more swastikas.
Brainwash and teach you hate.